Let's start today's episode with a quotation from the New York Times on March 10th, 1876. We'll just give you the headline here. Flesh descending in a shower, an astounding phenomenon in Kentucky, fresh meat like mutton or venison falling from a clear sky.
Yum?
Yes, they said like mutton or like venison. But what was it? Hi, I'm Ben.
Hey, I'm Noel, and it's raining meat. Mm. Hallelujah.
I was thinking the same
raining
thing.
Me. You were not.
Yeah, I was singing it when I walked in.
Why you got a one up me, Ben?
I'm not one up.
That was my song.
Now, you didn't even write It's Raining Men.
No, it's true.
Oh, but we are also joined by our super producer, Casey Pegram. And this is the first time the three of us have been back on the show together in a little while, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it has been a minute.
Probably like a month or something.
Oh my God, that voice from the sky. Like showers of meat in our mm-hmm. ears. Mm-hmm. Super producer Casey Pegram. Man, I've missed you guys.
Missed you.
I know. It's weird. Casey was in France for a while, mm-hmm. and then we were away, and then mm-hmm. I was away last mm-hmm. week, and here we are.
Here we are, and we decided, now that the three of us have reunited after far too long, that we were going to pick up our continuing mission to do an episode for every state in the United States. And we're going to hopefully succeed where Sufjan paused for a second.
I think it was a troll, honestly. I don't think he had any intention of doing it. He only made two.
Maybe he's got a back catalog.
It's been years.
Maybe he's just really stuck on Rhode Island.
You mean like a vault?
Yeah.
Like maybe unreleased state records that no one's going to ever hear?
Sort of like J.D. Salinger had all those stories that no one saw until after his death.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah. But hopefully a little bit different.
Well, speaking of stories.
Speaking of stories, Noel.
We got one today.
We do. So this episode will count for our Kentucky episode, right? And from this headline, you can tell that we're describing something pretty bizarre. You see, back in March 9th of, what did we say, 1876?
That's right.
Yeah. Back in March 9th in Bath County, Kentucky, there was someone named Alan Crouch. This guy lived about 2 or 3 miles from a place we've seen alternately called Olympian Springs in the original New York Times piece, but then later called, what was that?
This is Olympia Springs, so who knows?
Who knows? Probably the people that lived there, right? And Mrs. Crouch was out in the yard at the time. She was making soap, and then she looked around. She heard the pitter-patter of what she thought was, maybe the beginning of rain on a clear day without a cloud in the sky. And she looked around, and what was falling in her yard was not rain, not precipitation. It was meat.
Yeah, in an event that would go down in history as the Great Kentucky Meat Shower, which is not some kind of crazy mullet.
Right, or a weird euphemism. Also, I love the fact that they added great to the name because it implies that there were some other relatively mediocre
meat showers. There had to have been some lesser meat showers.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened? Why was meat raining from the sky? And it wasn't just like little pieces of meat. It was like all kinds of different mm-hmm. sized pieces of meat.
Yes, yeah. The ones that Mrs. Crouch saw were 3 to 4 inches square, so pretty substantial, mm-hmm. you know. And other people saw this too. It wasn't just Mrs. Crouch. And people tried to immediately figure out what this could be. And we have to remember that the people in this area at this time were well aware of other anecdotal stories of strange things falling from the sky. Rains of fish, for instance, you know, or a rain of stones. But these were often considered to be stories of old, you know, things you would read about in ancient texts.
Is there anything in the Bible about a plague of meat rain?
Surely there's some sort of supernatural-esque rain, but I don't think it's just straight-up meat, right?
Well, there's frogs.
Yeah, frogs.
They will eventually become meat.
I mean, if you're ambitious.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Not only did other people see it, but 2 people in the area got their gumption up, and they said, there's one easy way to figure out what kind of meat this is. Let's taste it.
Mm. Yeah, there was a guy named Harrison Gill, who is nearby, and who the New York Times article refers to as having unquestionable veracity. Mm-hmm. So he spoke the truth, and he was seeing these pieces of meat, like, sticking to fences and all scattered every which where. And, yeah, he was one of the ones that decided, let's give it a taste. And it was kind of argued between some of the tasters, the intrepid sky meat tasters, mm-hmm. whether it was bear or possibly venison, or a popular one was mutton.
Right, because they described a slightly gamey taste to it, and mutton and venison especially can be gamey. I've never eaten bear.
So. No, I haven't either, but I would assume it's super dark meat and very, very gamey. Although mutton, to me, it would be a dead giveaway because, you know, lamb and any kind of meat like mutton has a very, very distinct taste. It doesn't really taste like anything else.
So. Distinct is the correct word, I would think, there. And I don't even know if it's legal to eat a bear. That just, I'm not living the kind of life where that's come up yet. What about you?
Well, this is in the 1800s, so that was probably the Wild West as far as bear meat's concerned.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. The first explanation from a man of science at the time comes from a guy named Leopold Brandeis about, 3 months after the incident. He is able to get a hold of some of the specimens, it looks like a specimen, but he gets some of it, in a jar preserved or a bottle preserved in glycerin. And he starts poking around at it, and then he makes the declaration that while this may appear to be meat, it is not actually meat at all.
Wait, what?
Yeah, that's what he said. He said it was not, in fact, meat. He believed it was something called nostoc.
Oh, that's right. This is like a plant-based organism.
Yeah, it's a cyanobacteria that comes actually from the soil, from the ground. You can find it on moist rocks, bottoms of lakes and springs. It used to be called troll butter or witch jelly back in Europe.
You're joking.
No, that's true.
Those are amazing names for food products.
I know.
Troll jelly or witch butter?
Troll butter, witch jelly.
Well, I'm fine with flipping it, too.
They're both evocative.
This is great. I'm going to use those. Just for, I don't know. I don't know why yet, but I love those.
Yeah, I've been thinking the same thing. When this stuff is dry, it's pretty easy to miss. But when it's wet, it does have this jelly-like, I guess you could say maybe meat-esque appearance. But Brandy said that it's pretty easy to identify the subject. He was also, by the way, convinced this was true. The Kentucky Wonder is no more or less than nostoc. And people had known about the nostoc since the 1600s. I mean, that's how you get nicknames like witch jelly.
But how did it, where did it come from? What was his idea about how this stuff made it up into the atmosphere and then showered down upon this relatively small area?
It goes back to when it is dry versus when it is wet. So when this stuff is dry, it's so inconspicuous, people thought that it would float on the breeze until it rained. And then when it was raining, the nostoc would absorb the moisture and then it would fall from the sky as a jelly.
Interesting. But that's not the only theory.
That's not the only theory. We should also mention those other nicknames. Star slubber. I don't know.
I don't care for that one as
that
much.
That one feels somehow dirty. And then star jelly, which is still, I don't know, which is butter, which is jelly. Those are my picks. So he believed, Brandeis, of course, believed that this was the 100% absolute answer. But the problem is that for his theory to be correct, it would have had to have rained at some point, or there would have had to be at least some rain-bearing clouds in the sky. You know what I mean? Because the nostoc would have to absorb this moisture. And there wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was a perfectly clear day. And this meant that there were going to be other theories. Like you said, Noel, what was one of the other theories that came up?
Yeah, this is a pretty gross one. It was this notion from a guy named Dr. A. Mead Edwards, who believed that this meat stuff was actually lung from a horse, mm-hmm. or possibly an infant.
Yes, a human child.
Now, what's the deal with that? That's a lot of lung meat. you have to have a lot of babies to make that much lung meat. I mean, we're talking like, you know, sticking to the fences, Ben.
Right.
Scattered across the ground every which
Willy
way.
Willy-nilly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the problem, right? That explanation, it's even tougher to believe. But there is truth to it, right? They examined 7 samples of this meat shower, and they confirmed, I believe, 2 of them to be lung tissue, and 3 were muscle tissue, and 2 were made of cartilage. So there was lung tissue in there, but how would it come from human infant specifically or a horse? And also, how similar are the lungs of a horse and the lungs of a human infant?
Apparently quite.
Apparently distressingly similar. So what gives? People couldn't really answer that question, could they? They just said because it's lung tissue, we believe that it came from a human infant or a horse. But they didn't really explain how it could have gotten there. Into the sky, then onto the ground in Bath County.
That's the thing. No one seems to be looking for that particular solution. They're more like, what's the meat? It's mm-hmm. the mystery of the meat, not about how in the hell it ended up coming down from the sky.
Right.
That seemed like the least of people's concerns.
Which is strange, because it makes you think about priorities, you know? But again, there were more theories, right? Some more plausible than others.
So one of my favorite theories that actually does try to take a look at how this material could have managed to make it up into the sky and rain down upon these hapless people of Olympia blames this occurrence on a meteor shower.
Do tell.
Super meaty meteor shower. So here's a quote from the New York Times from William Livingston Alden. He wrote, according to the present theory of astronomers, an enormous belt of meteoric stones constantly revolves around the sun. And when the Earth comes in contact with this belt, she is soundly pelted. Okay, he goes on to say, similarly, we may suppose that there revolves around the sun a belt of venison, mutton, and other meats divided into small fragments, which are precipitated upon the Earth whenever the latter crosses their path. Help me unpack that, Ben.
I mean, it sounds like what it says on the tin.
Mm-hmm.
So how likely do you think that is?
Not very. I actually saw another version of this theory that said that this was like potentially like alien meat.
So this is space venison?
Space meat.
It's space venison. All right, space mutton. So that idea is fascinating. I don't know if it's true. I'm just going to say it. I don't want to be a pessimist. You know, I don't want to shut the guy down. What do you think?
Oh, I mean, it's bonkers.
You don't want to live in a world with space venison?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's not that I don't want to live in that world. It's just that I don't know that world exists.
How do they get up there?
I don't know. It was a real jump in this guy's. He's like, so there's this thing called asteroids, an asteroid belt. So if there's an asteroid belt, why couldn't there also be a similar belt of meat?
Maybe the guy was just very pro belt.
I don't know. I think he was high.
So, speaking of high, there may be another explanation, and it's an explanation that involves animals, birds, your favorite.
Gross.
Your favorites, bud. And this explanation originally came from an old farmer in Ohio who, upon learning of the meat shower, said, I have an explanation. It's not space venison. It's not human lung tissue. It's nothing that you guys have said before. It is, in fact, something that I've seen vultures do in the past. He said that this deluge of meat was actually a disgorgement of meat from vultures who were flying too high to be visible from the ground. And some vultures can fly as high as like a little less than 40,000 feet or 12,000 meters.
Jeez.
So it'd be tough to see them. And he said that this was vulture vomit. And then a little bit later, a guy named Dr. L.D. Kastenbein, writing in the Louisville Medical News, said, yeah, I think the farmer's right. I think this is vulture vomit. And he obtained his own sample, and he lit it on fire, and he was like, this is not just mutton, it's rancid mutton.
Mm-hmm.
And this made him believe that the culprits were vultures. They ate a dead sheep, and they flew off, but due to the weight of the meat they were carrying in their bodies, they were having a hard time flying, So they vomited in the sky to make it easier for them to fly.
Well, this is a thing that vultures do kind of on the reg. They'll unburden themselves of a heavy load of meat because, you know, they eat this stuff raw. They also have really acidic stomachs, I read.
That's true.
To aid in this digestion. And so sometimes they're so loaded down from gorging themselves on, you know, like a dead sheep, like you said, that they have to puke it up just to so they can fly properly.
And some vultures even vomit on their feet to regulate their temperature.
That's disgusting. Vultures are filthy, disgusting creatures.
They're very different. They're very different things. Have you ever seen them up close?
Just on the side of the road.
Yeah. You don't stop?
I don't go
you don't
for
pick up
close
a vulture.
Bird times. No, dude.
Checker.
Do you know what a group of vultures is called? It's cool. There's a different name for them depending on what they're doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Lay it on
me. So a group of vultures is a committee, a venue, or a vault, which I like. Which do you prefer?
I guess it depends on what they're doing.
A vault. Well, so then if they're in flight, they're a kettle.
I think I've heard that one, yeah.
And if they're feeding in a group, it's called the best one. It's called a wake.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. But what's a vault?
It's just like I said.
That's just general case.
They're interchangeable. A group of vultures can be either a committee, a venue, or a vault.
Do you know what a group of ravens is called?
It's an unkindness, right?
Yes, an unkindness of ravens. Yeah. So this vulture vomit explanation may not be particularly enjoyable or I don't know. It can be pretty disgusting, especially when we consider those two guys ate it. But it does give us the ability to conjecture a little bit about how the vultures came to vomit over Bath County. First off, vultures don't tend to fly of their own free will after they eat because they are digesting. So this means that something must have startled the vultures. We don't know what it was. Was it a sheep on a mission of revenge? Was it a farmer discovering the sheep and shooting at the vultures?
Yeah, and this is coming from a great article from Motherboard called The Mystery of the Kentucky Meat Shower by Kaylee Rogers. And she actually speaks to the vice president for field programs at the Wildlife Conservation Society, who says, his name is Joe Walston. He says, if you want to take off quickly with a huge amount of weight, the first thing you're going to do is vomit.
Which I think applies to everyone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I also pulled some vulture facts from this excellent book I want to recommend if you're ready for a deep dive into human-vulture relationships called Carrion Dreams. It's written by a guy named Benjamin Joel Wilkinson. And as far as I can tell, man, he is just super into the history of vultures. And he describes vultures in folklore and mythology as well. You know, if you go back to the ancient days of history. And one of the interesting things is that when and where a vulture vomits is also considered significant. In certain cultures or folkloric events, it's a sign, which is neat, you know. For instance, here in Georgia, it used to be a common, you know, folktale belief that if you deeply desire something, all you have to do is wish for it as you throw a kiss at a vulture and your wish will come true. But you had to be careful not to speak to a vulture while it was flying overhead, because if you did and it heard you, it would punish you by vomiting on you.
No.
So maybe.
Is that really in there?
That's really a thing. Yeah. I'm telling you, Carrion Dreams is a great book. It's also a very weird book. But so if that's true, perhaps somebody spoke to a vulture while it was flying over Kentucky.
Well, here's the thing, too. It's like this would have had to be a
multiple,
a group puke session.
A kettle. It'd have to be the whole kettle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole kettle puking, you know, en masse. Mm-hmm. And in this Motherboard article, they also speak to a guy named Kurt Goad, who's an art professor at Transylvania University in Lexington, and a self-professed expert in meat showers, is what he said. He proposes that this is definitely the most likely scenario that would have happened, because all of the meat was different sizes. It came, so which would have made sense if it had come from different animals that were, you know, chewing and feeding on different carcasses or whatever, and then ended up together. And they couldn't exactly ever figure out what types of animal that came from, but it would have been from all different kinds. Mm-hmm. And there was some, you know, cartilage and lung material in there as well. So it certainly was a mixed bag of meat.
And here's the thing. We don't know exactly how much meat actually fell. We don't have a measure of, you know, X amount of tons or this many pounds. Instead, we have, what's the phrase they use in most of the news at the time? They say it was enough to fill a horse wagon full. And for most people these days, that's not a, it's not a very easy rule of thumb kind of measurement, right?
Totally.
So there's a defense that Kurt comes up with in this, or Dr. Goad. He says that in 1876, if you said, oh, it was a horse wagon full of meat, that was the equivalent now of saying it's like a big gulp from McDonald's. So his argument is that horse wagons were ubiquitous enough at the time that most people would have a rough idea of what that size meant.
I'm trying to picture it. I'm sorry. I'm picturing this wagon full of meat.
That's the thing.
That's a lot.
Is it a wagon to carry horses, or is it a wagon that horses carry behind them? That makes a difference.
Oh, that's true. And I guess I'm just picturing one of those standard wagons with the little slats on the side that would be pulled behind a horse.
Yeah, where somebody sits up
on
the bench in the front.
Exactly. Yeah.
So either way, that's a distressing amount of meat to fall from the sky. What do you think? Is the mystery solved?
Well, I mean, with the most logical explanation being vulture vomit, I wonder how those townspeople felt about having, you know, snacked on some of that stuff out of curiosity. I think at the time, eating raw meat wasn't quite as, you know, frowned upon. Or they weren't really worried about foodborne illnesses so much.
I think, yeah, and I believe the idea was that one wouldn't get sick if you just tasted it rather than, you know, consuming a large amount of it or the amount that would be equivalent to a meal.
This certainly wouldn't have been like, oh, free food.
I don't know, man.
From heaven.
Yeah, manna. It's not a meaty manna situation.
Yeah.
There is a question here that we have for you, ridiculous historians. Which explanation do you think is the most plausible, or which do you wish was the true story? So we've got, let's see, we've got human flesh, we've got nostoc, we've got space venison, space meat, we've got a curse from a vulture, and then, of course, we just have a panicked vulture, a panicked kettle of vultures attempting to fly. I'll tell you, man, my favorites personally are either the space venison or the vulture curse.
You are all about this space venison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what people say about me. I guess we should add there are a couple more details that we can add to these theories. One, in terms of vulture behavior, is that have you ever seen those episodes of South Park or Family Guy? It's on so many comedy shows, this trope of one person throwing up and then everyone seeing them throw up and then they throw up as well in reaction.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. So vultures really do that. That's the thing. When they are flying in a group, if one goes, they all go.
See, this has got to be the answer.
Right. This doesn't invalidate a vulture curse. It may mean that the vultures vomit swarmed on them, cursing everyone in the town. So I guess the moral of the story, if that theory is true, is don't talk to vultures while they're busy.
I wouldn't go anywhere near the ugly bastards.
We had some more details, though, on is it a whole new theory or is it something to add to?
Well, I was trying to find a little more information about this supposed meteor shower, but there's really not a whole lot out there. It all kind of comes down to that quote about how there may be a belt of venison, mutton, and other meats divided into small fragments that are revolving around the sun, which is bizarre. But there's another one. The woman, I believe her name was Mary Crouch, who was making soap.
Yeah.
She apparently initially was scared that her husband and son, I believe, had been sucked up into the sky and shredded and eviscerated by an angry god and then rained down upon her in retribution.
For what? Soap?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Just being a sinner? It's an angry god up there, Ben.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever read that original sermon?
Yeah.
Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God.
It's a wild one. We should do an episode on that.
We should. We should. Actually, I have a lot of that. I have a lot of the work from that time. But for now, we believe that we have solved, to a great degree, the mystery of the Kentucky meat shower.
But we didn't do it.
We, well, I say we as the human species.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, whenever people say we, they usually mean in a global event like the human species, right?
I agree. And I thought of a better musical theme for this episode, actually, better than It's Raining Meat.
What is it?
Red rain is coming down. Red rain is falling. Which is a totally useless Peter Gabriel song to me, mm-hmm. but completely useful in this context.
Well, you're welcome, Peter. And what better note to end our show on today? Thank you so much for listening. Let us know, especially if you happen to live in this area of Kentucky, let us know if people still talk about this strange event in 1876. And if so, what do they say about it?
And have you heard of any of the lesser meat showers mm-hmm. of other locales?
I'm very interested to hear that, yeah. Or have you heard of any other extraordinary stories of things falling from the sky in your neck of the global woods? If so, let us know. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, especially on one of our favorite places on the internet, our Facebook community page, Ridiculous Historians, where, you know, we see some cool stuff.
Stuff happens there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place in our hearts and also on the internet.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to describe it. Additionally, we'd like to thank, as always, super producer Casey Pegram.
We'd like to thank Alex Williams, who composed our theme, our research pals Christopher Hasiotis and Eves Jeffcoat. And I believe, Ben, we have a new member to the Ridiculous History research team as Christopher and Eves kind of move on to start working on some stuff of their own.
Yes, thank you to Gabriel Luzier, who, funny story, used to also work with Mental Floss.
That's awesome.
I love that magazine.
We're happy to have him.
Yeah. So that's it for today, but stay tuned for next time when we reveal... Wait. Did you hear that?
You know I heard it, Ben.
I was going to just keep going.
It's time, gentlemen.
Wow,
Jonathan Strickland, the Quister.
You really leaned into that one.
Well, it's been a long time. I have to make up for lost time.
It has been a long time. And although we are sworn nemeses, I just want to check in real quick. How you been doing?
Pretty good. Kids are great.
Just like kids in general are
just
great?
Just in general, yeah. I don't have any children myself. But, you know, they seem to be going to school, and I understand that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, things are... You know, things are fine.
Did they learn about the Great Kentucky Meat Shower in school?
Or any of the other showers that are implied by that title?
Well, in fact, we're going to be exploring a shower of our own, my friends. Get in the shower with me, my buddies.
No.
Come on in.
Okay, a shower of the mind, at
least.
The
weird animals are just fine. Now, listen, we know that I am part of the most cringeworthy segment in all of podcasting, in which I, the Quizster, show up and I pose a scenario to the two of you, and you determine whether or not it is actually representative of a real thing, what happened in history, or I done made it all upsies, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get 3 minutes. You can discuss amongst yourselves for 3 minutes. Your
ideas. Can we phone
ideas.
A friend? Can we rope Casey into this?
No,
maybe?
If you had friends, you could in fact phone them. But I know for a fact
that's,
you are friendly.
That's hurtful. Mm. We're not friends.
Are you kidding? We're
not. Oh, right. I see. I always confuse this.
Okay. But in addition to that, you also add one arbitrary rule.
Right. So that if you wish to ask any question to me, you must first obey a rule of arbitrary nature that I make up. Typically 2 minutes before I come in here.
Okay.
And you have to do that in order to ask a question. I will tell you what that rule is after I have given you your scenario.
All right. You know what? I'm feeling good. I'm feeling all right. Noel, Casey, I think we got this.
I will. I'll give you the scenario.
Okay.
I will give you your arbitrary rule, and then time will begin.
At which point, I will vault over to that gigantic grandfather clock.
You'll pull the pull cord, get the diesel engine going. Yeah.
All right.
It gets really fumey in here, by the way. All right, here's your scenario. In 1402, in Shropshire, England, locals were perplexed by what they described as a rain of worms falling upon the village, in what amounted to thousands of worms covering the entire area, including the rooftops of several buildings. The odd weather was met not with superstition and fear, as we'd usually guess, but with a sort of bewildered amusement. However, this historical event would later be immortalized by none other than William Shakespeare, who fudged the date so that it happened more than a year later on the eve of the Battle of Shrewsbury, which features in Henry IV, Part 1. In Act 4, Scene 1, Harry Hotspur Percy, the leader of a rebellion against Henry IV, says, Yester-een, they do say that worms fell as though rain. Fortune is so disposed to us that nature herself turns against this pretender king. In the mid-19th century, when Shakespeare's plays became more popular, Shropshire began what would become an annual tradition, a festival day celebrating the Rain of Worms. It happens every year on the second Saturday of April. And your arbitrary rule is you must quote Shakespeare, any Shakespeare, before asking me a question. Begin the time.
I'm taking a run for it, and we are...
Okay, we're good!
You've made worms meat of me.
You have a question, Noel?
I do. I don't know, I just wanted to quote some Shakespeare. I don't really have any questions.
That's fair. That's a good quote.
Very well, I bite my thumb at you.
A Romeo and Juliet reference, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so this festival, mm-hmm. What's the name of it again?
It is known as the Rain of Worms Festival.
And it is?
Second Saturday of every April.
In your story, it's ongoing.
It is ongoing.
In your story.
It is ongoing.
Casey, what do you think? Oh, just for so.
Wait, we're letting Casey come into this.
I asked you that earlier, yeah. And you ignored me and said I had no friends. Well, so
for everybody listening, what happened when you heard that dead air and those pauses between the Quister and myself? I was staring at him to read body language, somewhat unsuccessfully. All right, Casey, what's your take, man?
Oh boy, see, I hate this because whenever you and Noel are not in agreement on something, I'm going to be the tiebreaker, and I'm probably going to get it wrong most of the time.
I don't know. We usually tend to be on the same page pretty quickly.
No, you do rock, paper, scissors every time.
So? We've got a shtick that works, man.
But that means that you're at opposition with one another. If you were in agreement, you wouldn't have to do rock, paper, scissors.
That's what... You can only really do rock, paper, scissors with friends. I don't know if you have a lot of friends, Jonathan, but if you have friends and you play rock, paper, scissors. Okay, look, we're at a minute 20.
I kind of think this is true, but I could be completely wrong, or it could be from a different Shakespeare play, or I don't know.
That's kind of how this works, though, you know? Yeah.
I'm just skeptical that they're of the... Initially, I'm skeptical of a festival built on worms, because people in general aren't wild about worms.
Oh, interesting. Ah, Ben.
I don't know.
Wow. Okay.
This one's taken the longest because usually we've nailed something down by now. We're at 50 seconds.
I'm going to say not real.
You know what? I'm tempted to say the same thing just because it was so detailed. You want to lock it in?
Let's lock it in.
And you'll come back if we're... Okay. All right. 3, 2, 1. False.
Sorry. I know that's how we're doing.
You're correct.
Yeah!
Oh!
There was no Rain of Worms in 1402 in Shropshire, England. I made up the line from Henry IV, Part 1. There is a line that does say that that fortune is disposed to us, but Hotspur says it in a completely different context. There's no festival of the Rain of Worms. I would have heard of this.
It's a little Lovecraftian,
it's
just from the branding.
Shropshire, England. You probably wouldn't have heard about
that's
it.
Fair.
I had prepared an explanation or description of the festival, but you had sussed it out so early that I didn't have a chance to.
Where does this
further?
Where is the count now? Where does this put us?
Oh, you're getting a little closer. I want to say that maybe I'm one or two ahead. Honestly, it's been so long that I just declared myself supreme winner of all things for all time.
Hey, I've got an idea. You should come back.
Oh, so you want to have yet another matching of wits.
Oh, that's a strong word. I thought I would give you another chance to do a little better next time.
I'll go and count them up if you want me to. I'm pretty sure I'm at least one or two ahead. But it is on like the Donkey Kong, Mr. Bolin.
Fantastic. Well, no, we got a win.
We did get a win. Sometimes you just need a win.
And thanks, Casey. Thanks for intervening in there, too. That was really cool.
I appreciate that you believe in me, Casey.
So, this concludes our episode, but not our show. Stay tuned next time when we explore the strange, hilarious, somewhat disgusting, definitely ridiculous method that scientists use to trace the path of the Lewis and Clark expedition.
It's the smell test.